This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel says his district will be asking voters to approve a property tax hike.
We'll be ramping up for that in the very near future. We're looking for a community person to lead that. We can't lead it as school officials.
Daniel explores the potential for a 2020 referendum with GLT's Mary Cullen. Plus, fiscal conservative Bloomington Council candidate Donna Boland says she wants to cut city personnel costs without cutting the number of employees. Boland talks about her Ward 2 race with Ryan Denham. And Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen says the institution has made some progress on recouping enrollment. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Bloomington is considering a new insurance program to protect residents from big unexpected spikes in their water bills if there is a leak. GLT's Ryan Denham is in studio with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner for more from last night's meeting.
Mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan. Great to be here as usual.
The city is exploring a water leak insurance program for residents. The city was essentially tack on an extra $1.50 to monthly bills, and that would protect residents from a huge bill should they ever have a leak or some kind of damage that pops up. So what do you think of this proposal?
I think it's a great proposal, but let's be clear. This is not mandatory. So if somebody does not want to pay it, they don't have to pay it. They can opt out of the protection against a big water bill, and there's a separate insurance for the water and sewer lines themselves. So let's say somebody drives over your property and breaks your sewer line, okay, or your water line, and then you have a massive bill. Well, that doesn't fix the pipe, so that's a separate issue. So, but both of those are things that if the a particular household wants to opt out, they don't want to have anything to do with it, they don't have to pay it. I would highly recommend that they do so. I will certainly do so myself. But the water spiking is would be, as you mentioned, a little over a dollar, up to a dollar and a half, for up to $2,500 worth of coverage. And the other issue would be about $4 and change a piece. We may, there was some indication, we might be able to get some kind of reduction for people who subscribe to all three from this company. But that would mean you would make a phone call and you would send them an invoice and they would fix your line no matter how old it is. And no deductible. The entire cost of fixing your sewer line or your water line that people don't realize is their responsibility between the city's water main and the street and their home. And so there are no rude surprises.
Well, just to clarify, so what would be opt out versus opt in?
The water would be, that is the spiking of the water, that would be somewhere between $1 and $1.50 a month. That would be opt out. So that is, we would enroll everyone. The national average, as they told us last night, was 96% enrollment. 4% of people opt out, and that's certainly their option. The opt in. So if you wanted to the coverage for to fix the actual problem of, let's say, your water line or sewer line, no matter how old it is, they will go in and fix it, no deductible. That would be $4 and some a month per, each line. You would have to opt in. Now, this is still administered through the city and the company, but this is at least an option. We did not act last night. Let's be clear. That was just the first discussion. I'll have a special mayor's open house where there's a presentation. We will discuss this again, with the council before moving forward. We want to get some public feedback and some thoughts that people might have as to how we might be able to tweak this.
Yeah, and Alderman Jamie Mathey talked about, you know, his plans to kind of reach out to people and get some more feedback.
Absolutely.
So what are the questions that you personally have about this program ahead of whenever this thing does come back for a vote, potentially?
Well, my questions were answered last night, and where we're in the packet. And that is, first of all, is there a deductible? What is the process? Alderman Milwambwe asked this. What is the process? Let's say my water line breaks. If it's because somebody drove a truck over my grass, are you going to say, hey, no, that's not it? No. Regardless of why it breaks, the water line or the sewer line will be fixed. How does that merge with other insurance? Alderwoman Bray asked that question. And she kind of followed up. She's a state farm attorney who deals with this. And so she grilled them appropriately. And so I think, from my perspective, I think a pretty clear picture of what this is. And that's why I pretty confidently said, I won't opt out and I will opt in to the two programs themselves. I think that are a great way to protect our citizens from really unexpected things. I hear it more often than not. I think the estimate of the figure was somewhere around 10% of people have some sort of unusual spiking of their water bill each year. Now, if it's a running toilet, it might only be $200 or $300. If it's a sump pump, which was my situation, it was more like around $900. And that doesn't fix your, you know, the problem in the water line. So these are things that can, for a small increment each month, make sure that you don't have these crazy surprises.
And then the water department would not be getting quite as many calls from folks wondering what's going on and how to deal with it.
Absolutely. And so there would be some, we would hope that there would ultimately be some sort of administrative savings as well.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, since you last visited, the city of Bloomington lost another anchor store at Eastland Mall. Sears announced it's going to be closing this fall. What are you hearing at this point from the mall's owner, CBL Properties, about the mall's future?
Well, I'm probably not hearing much more than you're hearing. And we did have a meeting about, let's see, a year and 3 months ago, and just shortly after the closing of Macy's. And then, of course, we had the closing, or having the closing of Bergner's. And we're not alone in enclosed malls, and they know that. The discussion at that time was, if you know you need to make the transition to a College Hills Mall type of situation, where it's an open-air mall, you need to have affinities like a hotel or perhaps an apartment building and other restaurants, then let's work on that. And they did have plans. At this point, we do know that there's, I guess, a Planet Fitness going in. I would hope that we would not take a Band-Aid approach to this. We need a more systematic approach to what's going on. And so at this point, all of what I would call underperforming areas or neighborhoods or whatever are very high, if not the most high, on my priority list, whether that's downtown or some of the neighborhoods adjacent to downtown or whether it's Eastland Mall. Those are our highest priorities right now.
And you've talked a lot since you've been on about the urgency of economic development and moving fast.
Absolutely.
Do you sense that the city needs to do more reach out to CBL or do you still sense that the ball is in their court?
Well, to some degree, you can't force somebody who is a private owner to do something with their property, but you can let them know that you're willing to work with them and to help them in that process.
And you feel the city's done that?
Yes, and we're going to continue to do that. Expedited permitting or whatever else we might do. There could be a special service area where we add maybe for those stores, maybe a half penny sales tax that is then rebated back to them to cover some of their costs of new construction or whatever. There are any number of tools. Our last resort is a TIF district, but that's also something else that we could conceivably work with on them.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham here with Mayor Terry Renner. Last week, I covered the Bloomington Transportation Commission's meeting. They spent a lot of time talking about speeding, especially in residential neighborhoods. The commission's chair, Michael Gorman, expressed support for a broad lowering of speed limits across Bloomington and a more liberal use of traffic calming devices. So that's curb extensions, lane narrowing, that kind of thing. Do you think that's an issue that needs more city attention at this point?
Well, I think it depends upon the neighborhood and the area. Absolutely. In terms of if something's a purely residential area, purely residential neighborhood, yes. And one of the ways is to kind of have road diets, and that is to make the lanes narrower. And so you have, you tend to have almost a natural slowing of traffic if there are lots of children or if there are handicapped children or people in a particular area, then absolutely. Now, we have some controversies along Hershey Road, right? Hershey Road, you know, there's a lot of bad zoning there from the past. So, you know, we could complain about the decisions of the past, but there are lots of businesses, and then there are residential areas.
And Hershey is a road in which you actually the city council lowered the speed limit, right?
In part of it. So parts of it are 30, parts of it are 35, and then it goes back down to 30. Depends on which ward it's into. And this is Hershey is another story, and I'm not sure what the appropriate approach is there, other than some of the things that we have up right now, actually, which tells you how fast you're going, or if you're going over 30, or if you're going over 35, if that's a speed limit, it flashes at you. And I think those kinds of traffic calming devices are very useful. What will certainly get people upset is if we have traffic enforcement with police officers and they begin to get more tickets. Now, there are some people who argue that that's far more effective, and they're correct. The difficulty is often, and this happened in my neighborhood, where we had people who complained of that people were going too fast. So the police officers went out and they gave tickets to people, and including many of the people who complained that people were driving too fast. and then they didn't want the police to monitor quite as aggressively. So, but I do support the general movement of the Transportation Committee, and Mr. Gorman certainly is very well aware of these kinds of issues and making physical changes too in roads. It doesn't always have to be you've got a cop out there with a radar and they're giving you tickets. There are many other alternatives.
Well, I do want to ask one more question on the cop side of it, though. Several years ago, I remember the Bloomington Police Department having a traffic enforcement division. It was four or five officers and a supervisor, and that was sort of their task. They don't have that anymore. I assume partly budget, partly the demands of other patrol needs that the department has. But do you think that there is any interest in the council in funding a reemergence of a division like that within police that would be more devoted to traffic enforcement?
Not that I know of. There's not a member of the council who has specifically mentioned that to me. It has, we have speed limits certainly have come up. Road diets have come up. That particular option has not. And that's also quite costly. And there may be other ways that we can achieve that goal. Let's say if you're hiring a police officer and you include personnel, the payments to salary, compensation, benefits, pensions, those are, if you even hire four additional police officers, that's a good $400,000 or more. So that doesn't mean that there's not some support on the council. We've just not had that conversation yet.
Also at that same Transportation Commission meeting, it talks about how road work is paid for. The big packet of information that was given to commissioners ahead of that meeting suggested that city staff is getting ready to bring the local motor fuel tax back before the council at some point, asking aldermen to double the local motor fuel tax from 4 cents up to 8 cents. That's been floated before. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that will come before the council here in the short term?
I think that that's possible. I think that it will come. If it doesn't come with this budget cycle, it will probably come in the next budget cycle, because we are making some improvements in our roads. But if we really want to take it to the next level and make up for decades, frankly, of neglect, we're going to have to pay for it somehow. Roads do not pay them for themselves. And we already have about 150 fewer employees than we had even 8-9 years ago in the city. So we have made some the cuts have been quite substantial, and that doesn't mean there aren't other things that we can economize on. But we're not going to terribly be easily fined $5-8 million out of our budget that we can allocate toward more street resurfacing. And the other thing is that I do favor taking the gas tax from 4 cents to 8 cents for a variety of reasons. First of all, that money has to be used on streets. Okay? It cannot be used legally on anything else. It's got to be used on streets and infrastructure. Now, the other thing is that about 30% of that gas tax is paid for by people who do not live in the city of Bloomington, and yet they do drive on our streets. The other thing is in the international political economy, a 4-cent gas tax, and some of that may very well be absorbed by the gas station. There's no automatic 4-cent, you know, tack on. Of all of the factors that affect gasoline prices, a 4-penny gas tax by a local municipality is a very small piece of that pie. You know, if there happens to be an Arab oil embargo, that will drive up the price a buck or more. The 4 cents that is earmarked for infrastructure, I think, is a very good investment for the future. And we've got to understand that we can complain about the years of neglect, decades of neglect of our streets, but right now we've got to figure out how to do something about it. And I think moving forward, that's a very good option.
One last thing here before I get you out of here. The Pantograph is doing a series this week on affordable housing needs in Bloomington Normal. It's similar to a series we did here at GLT last year. The Pantograph's reporting was sparked by a more recent regional housing study spearheaded by the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. Where do you see the need for more affordable housing in Bloomington?
I think we have needs for affordable housing throughout the city of Bloomington. And now that we are a very wealthy community, we're the wealthiest community in downstate Illinois. But that does not mean that we don't have problems with affordable housing. And we don't have the problems of a San Francisco or a Chicago. That's not my point. But we still do have people who have a great deal of difficulty. And as the Pantograph series did point out, some of that is influenced by the number of students that we have. And I'm not blaming students, but it's just the students who go out and rent, that means there's a greater demand. And then with a greater demand, the cost of rentals are comparatively high to the cost of purchasing a home, for example. And so absolutely, I'm glad that the Pantograph is focused on that. I'm glad you're bringing this up right now. I think the more that we begin to understand that there are quite a few people, there are a large core of people within McLean County, somewhere around 20%, who really can't afford the housing that most of us would think is barely adequate.
There was talk of an affordable housing project on Washington Street, just to the east of downtown. Are there other projects that are maybe coming down the pike or that have potential that you're aware of in the city?
Yes, mostly I can't talk about the specifics of them because we're talking about some legal relationships. But there's definitely interest in by more than one person. More than one firm in some sort of affordable housing on the old Electrolux site, which would be near the affordable housing that would be senior affordable housing a few hundred feet away in the old Bloomington Junior High School. So, yes, those are certainly some possibilities. And in fact, we do hear from developers who are a little less serious, and when we vet them, we realize that their track record is not very good. So I think that there are definitely some possibilities of developers who have a good track record that we want to work with moving forward on affordable housing.
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks again for your time today on Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos.
Support for GLT comes from SEFCU, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFCU even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. Still to come, the Bloomington City Council Ward 2 seat is up for grabs, and we'll hear from one of the candidates to succeed David Sage. Unit 5 is in the process of issuing $16.5 million in working cash fund bonds. This comes after the district decided to forego placing a referendum on this year's ballot. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel about the need for a referendum in the future, redistricting plans, and more.
Last year, GLT asked about redistricting to better balance student loads among buildings. Unit 5 did a study. You talked about scheduling public input, and then the district backed off, saying that you thought you could make do. Now there's about 700 more students at Normal Community than Normal West. Do you still feel that way?
Actually, the enrollments are lower at Normal Community than they were last year. So that tells us that with what's been happening in our local economy and local community, that we'll not be able or will not need to look at redistricting.
Some NCHS students were asked to volunteer to give up their lockers. Some teachers are telling us they have concerns about safety from overcrowding in disaster drills, where the safe places might be overfilled. Class sizes at community have crept above 30 in many cases, even with online courses to soak up some of the overage. Yeah. That can't be great. Why not bite the political bullet and redistrict all high schools, even if the elementaries are okay?
A good question. All of our high schools, actually, they'll find classes over 30. Not the best case scenario for us, so be it at West or be it at Normal Community. In regards to actual number of folks in a building, if you look at the fire department, and what is allowed and not allowed, we're not even close to any one of the buildings. However, we do look at lockers. We do look at what's the usage of lockers. You mentioned that topic. In reality, students use those less and less. They carry things in their book bags. They very infrequently, some don't even, they'll never use a locker. So that was one of the solutions principal came up with to say, do we really need those lockers? No. Are they potentially sharing? Yes. But in reality, we've added additional lockers and we'll continue to look at that as a need, but our enrollment is decreasing. And that's, again, as we look at that whole trend line, we're going to continue to closely monitor it and have the proper facilities. So we do see a trend in more blended learning, which is a new course instructional process, if you will. And that means that there might be only 3 days a student is in a physical classroom. The other 2 days they'll go to more of a commons area, that therefore more of a college structure. Nice to transition our juniors and seniors into that type of format so they become more accustomed to. It is also your responsibility on those days where you're not having direct instruction. However, that also affords teachers to have individualized time with students who need additional assistance. So we're going to look at more and more of those strategies, and some districts have really accelerated that process. We're at the very beginning of that stage. Likewise, more and more of our students are looking for additional coursework from universities, be it Heartland Community College, be it ISU, we're very open to that as well. So the physical plan itself, I believe we're well positioned.
So again, some teachers are saying the class sizes are above 30. You just confirmed that. And if a student doesn't pass, the cohorts following make it impossible for the student to take the course again in the classroom because these classes are full. So they're forced to take it online, kind of like this method that we were just talking about. But often their chances of mastery are lower in those online classes than if they had that real-time front face-to-face with a teacher. Is that something that's significant in the decision whether or not to redistrict the schools?
Has absolutely nothing to do with redistricting. That has to do with what courses are available. Both high schools, as I said, have, in our secondary world, we're not as clean. And I say the word clean because we have ranges within our elementaries. High school and junior high, you'll have some core subjects or even some non-core, in other words, elective courses, that they will range from. You could have a high of 34 or 35, but then you could have a low of 15. So you look at an overall average for teachers in the secondary world, and we're fairly consistent in that realm. In regards to students finding additional coursework, we are looking at a, if you will, a career development center, where students who have failed the core classes, because those have to be, they have to find a way to master those courses and pass those classes. They can't graduate without them. So we're trying to utilize other systems with certified teachers in those career centers that can help students. If you go online, I totally agree. If you're strictly using online courses with no assistance or mentoring, the success rate of those students is very low, even to the low as 15 to 20%. So therefore, we've discovered you don't do that. In other words, you allow students to have some assistance with certified teachers, and also hopefully if they have other questions, they can go back to their core teacher. But bottom line is, how do we enable students to pass their courses and therefore produce graduates?
So you said overall enrollment is declining a little bit, 200 from last year. Can you explain why?
Don't know the exact reason, but we have some theories in regards to that. One theory would be, first of all, there's been, as we looked at general population itself, there's been a decrease in birth rate. We knew that was going to come through, so that's very natural. But we also have seen, from a local economy standpoint, a reduction of students, and not in the elementary level, but in the secondary level, which may coincide with what's happening with some of our major employers in town.
Are we talking about State Farm? Is there a State Farm effect?
I think there probably is a State Farm effect. And we're not really feeling it just yet because, well, we're feeling it somewhat in regards to perhaps these numbers. But there's not, it's one of those effects that we may see it slowly, but we're also hearing there may be some additional rehiring because of closing of other facilities across the country. So with that said, as we've talked with State Farm, it's been, we're going to maintain the level basically where we are. And my question would be, is that, would those be families with children? Would those be families such as much younger couples that have yet to have children? Therefore, we're not seeing that in our schools yet. So that's a hard one to gauge because we don't track where people are employed.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel. Now, switching gears a bit, word in the community was that Unit 5 would be going for a referendum this November. July and August have come and gone, and it's too late to mount an effective campaign. What changed the district's mind about seeking extra money from property taxpayers?
Well, again, the local economy, what was happening locally, what was happening in regards to the uncertainty. It would have been a very, I would say, extremely uphill battle. Plus that, we know we have a structural deficit. We're dealing with that. But we really do want to support our local community and have local community support and spread that through our the process of a referendum. So we'll be ramping up for that, I think, in the very near future. We're looking for a community person to lead that because you must have a community person. We can't lead it as school officials. But again, the quality of education in Bloomington Normal's, I would say, exceptional. We want to maintain that quality, which means from an education fund standpoint, we need that funding. We haven't had an increase in that over the past 30 years, if I'm correct, no more than 10 cents in the past 30 years. And you can't survive based on that. Definitely costs have increased. In regards to our contracts, regards to equipment and supplies and so on and so forth. So with that, we know what's going to have to happen. And we're looking now not at the November because of primarily the uncertainty of where we are as a community at this current time.
So Unit 5 approved a new teacher contract earlier this year and raised base entry-level salaries to restore some lost wage competitiveness. But the district doesn't have a way to pay for it, and it's using dwindling reserves. Does that make the case for a referendum more difficult?
No, I think it makes the case more powerful, actually. Again, you mentioned high school class sizes of 30. If I look at our elementary classes, we've tried to stay within the range, but we do have classes that are outside the range. we're seeing more and more needs of students, especially in the early pre-K through fifth grade. Areas in special needs, they continue to increase. What public schools do for students is far beyond, I think, what the actual public understands. With that, there's a price tag. And either we continue to support those programs or we have to eliminate programs. And it's that simple. I think the overall message to our community will be, here are our options. We as a community, please support. And certainly I will support, but I will tell you that if we don't support, then it's not a good case scenario. And as far as you can look at co-curriculars, you can look at programs within the regular school day, all those will be impacted. And that's not beneficial for a community, especially if you want a quality educational program. And I also would say this, without a quality educational program, you're not going to have a quality community.
So will Unit 5 have to make significant budget and program cuts before going for a referendum?
Not before, because we have that built into our schedule. But there will become a deadline where we'll have to make those significant cuts if we aren't successful.
So the cuts would have to come afterwards?
Yes, and so the way teacher contracts run and so forth, we truly do our hiring, fulfilling of those contracts by the end of March. So we'd have to actually think of that even before. Again, that's about a year and a half down the road at least, but it's very much on our minds and the strategies of how to lay out that timeline and hopefully have some type of campaign, a campaign that ultimately has to be successful.
Right. So when will a referendum be needed in a critical way, since even with the new funding formula, there isn't a clear sign that the state will be increasing funding for districts by significant amounts?
So we have about a year and a half, and that's our time frame. But again, we'd really like to start the process in November or December of this year.
Unit 5 is also in the process of issuing $16.5 million in working cash fund bonds. How long does the district plan to keep that fund active?
That will basically cover our education fund for 2 years.
Okay. And
including
then,
our reserves.
Okay. And what's the cost to keep it active?
Well, again, that cost is how does that impact your property values? And we don't know what the interest rates will be on those bonds, but we anticipate them being in the 2% to 2.5% to 3% range, and that's the cost.
There continues to be low-level chatter in the community about the prospect of Unit 5 building a field house for sports usable by both high schools. Where do those discussions stand today?
You know, I don't know where those are, so I can't address those. I've not been part of that discussion. Again, I'll just say from our viewpoint, from a school perspective, we have excellent facilities. We'll continue to maintain those facilities because we believe that's what our citizens want of us as school officials and as a school board. We have almost $2 billion in property assets and property equipment, so in buildings. So therefore, we are very strategic in how we continue to maintain those. And I'll also say this, from the perspective of a community-type program, I think having witnessed in other communities, it is definitely an economic boost if it's done well. And my advice would be do it well if it's going to happen. And see what kind of outside then participants and teams and whatever would happen at that point in time. The flow of additional funds because of lodging, restaurants, and various other things, you know, fast food, not just fast food, but your everything retail-wise, that's important. And there are some communities, someone's going to do that. And since we are sort of a hub for IHSA activities, it seems like a very natural fit for us to be hub for other club-type activities, whether it be soccer, volleyball, softball, which we already are, various other sports and activities that now are truly led by clubs, which are remedied by a great amount of traveling And if you've ever been part of a traveling team, as having a young daughter who was involved in those, it is rather extensive. And you spend quite a bit of dollars in those communities that you play in. So with that, you want quality facilities, and we'll see what happens with this.
Unit 5 School Superintendent Mark Daniel talking with GLT's Mary Cullen. Based on the current schedule, Unit 5 will receive proceeds from the $16.5 million in working cash fund bonds in early November.
Ordinary bag of potato chips could listen to every word you said. Does it work with Doritos?
I suspect so.
Lay's, I'm assuming, will work fine.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm Guy Raz. What potato chips tell us about the hidden secrets all around us? Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. More information about the impact you could have at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schleicher. The Bloomington City Council will lose one of its most fiscally conservative voices next spring when David Sage steps down after three terms. Donna Bolin wants to take over that role on the council. The frequent public commenter at council meetings has announced a run for Ward 2 on Bloomington's southwest side. In this interview with GLT's Ryan Dunham, Bolin says her campaign's top priorities will be financial planning and fiscal restraint.
I think I have something to offer to help with the financial stability of the city. I've been attending the meetings for 5 years, and there's a lot of change going on in the city, and I think I can help with that. I'm familiar with the issues that the city faces and some of the history. I've been here 26 years, so I've seen a lot.
What would be your key issues if you were to become elected next April?
Well, one of the top five priorities of the council is financial planning, and that is not often mentioned. Infrastructure is mentioned, and downtown development, which is also one of the five. But I think that without good, sound financial planning, you cannot revitalize anything. So that's going to be my focus.
And when you say financial planning, what do you mean? What could the city be doing differently?
Well, I think that monthly reports, financial reports, should be presented to the council. And a group of citizens has already recommended that. So that every month, before a decision is made, that the council can look where we are financially, because every decision they make this year affects future budgets. So be informed.
So last winter and spring, aldermen had to close a $2.9 million deficit. They made some tough decisions, like raising garbage and sewer fees, cutting back on services like bulk waste pickup. So what would be your approach to balancing city budgets in difficult times like these?
Well, I work with what I have. And regarding the budget, I would always look for efficiencies and strategic savings. I worked with Diana Hallman. There was a group of five or six of us that worked with her that took a deep dive into the budget. And I enjoyed working with Steve Rasmussen on that. And I think that he took to heart some of the things that our group said. And is going to move forward with that. As far as the items, I don't think that we should risk our financial resources. I think we need to be a bit conservative, careful, and again, because of the current economic situation in the city. I surveyed some of the residents in Ward 2 after I announced, and most of them, well, a good majority of them, view the economy as being stable but declining. So that says a lot. And so we need, as a representative, I would need to focus on stabilizing rather than growing. We need to be stable before we can look at growing.
Where do you suspect that there are inefficiencies in city operations to try to save some money?
Well, if you watch the video or from last Monday's meeting, they discussed benefit plan for the employees. And for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been addressing the issue of pension spiking, which since 3 years ago, the city has what I consider wasted $2 million. It's not in the budget. The money has to be taken from some other account. So that policy is being changed, or it has been ruled on by the court, so that policy will be changed in the future. We can save an average of $300,000 a year by doing that. Now, they also hired a consultant or want to hire a consultant to evaluate the benefit packages for the employees. And depending on those results, negotiations with the unions will come forward and hopefully there will be some savings. I don't want to cut employees. We need the employees to provide the service. But what I would like is if every employee is willing to give up, pay a little bit more for their health insurance, and everybody would benefit. It would be like a win-win.
How do you think they could sell that to the employees of the city? Or do they not have to, in your view?
I'm glad that I don't really have to. I think that's between the city manager, the HR department, and the unions and the department heads. Because the city council, as far as I know, I've never been behind closed doors. As far as I know, they review the contracts and then vote them in.
So do you think that the city should be spending more on streets and taking care of its streets?
That is one of the city's top priorities, and it is one of the things that the citizens are demanding.
What do you think?
Well, I do think that they need to be taken care of, and they have for a long time. And personally, I think that having visible poor infrastructure sends a very poor message to anyone that wants to come here. It's kind of like when you sell your house, you want to have good curb appeal. Well, the city is not offering good curb appeal at this point in time.
Do you support spending more money on streets?
What I support is, again, looking for efficiencies and then applying those efficiencies to basic infrastructure.
Economic development is a key priority for the new city manager, Tim Gleason. The mayor has talked about his dissatisfaction with the pace of the city's economic development efforts. What do you think about how the city has handled economic development in the last few years? And as a council member, would you try to take the city in any different directions?
This is my opinion, and I've always expressed this at a council meeting, that bringing in jobs that pay the equivalent to the median home income, household income, provides prosperity. And that needs to be addressed. The city provides a whole lot of money to all sorts of economic development groups, EDC, BN Advantage, etc. Those groups need to be given specific goals, timeline, let's say 500 jobs in 2 years. They need to report back. I believe that there should be a clearly written, enforceable ordinance that holds them accountable.
Do you think that the EDC and the BN Advantage, that contingent of our community, do you think they've not been held adequately accountable with the tax money they've been given?
I don't see results. That's all I can say.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Donna Bolin, a newly announced candidate for Bloomington City Council in Ward 2. She'd be running for David Sage's seat. He's not seeking re-election next year. Georgine Chazelle has also announced plans to run in Ward 2. So, Donna, what do you think about downtown Bloomington? There's been a lot of discussion circling around the council in the last year or so. A task force report has come out. There is some interest now in city administration. What do you want to see happen in downtown Bloomington?
I would like to see downtown Bloomington be refreshed, but there are other areas in the city that also need attention. I believe that for downtown, incremental steps rather than trying to convert it completely. They already have spent money for signage, which will benefit. They're going to put parks. They've been doing art installations or plan on doing art installations. But then I believe step back and see if what you've done is successful. And then in the meantime, address other issues in the city.
What about library expansion? So the council is, I think, set to talk again in the fall about the prospect of a possible library expansion. They have some new kind of design concepts that the library board is going to be bringing up and back to the council. Do you think now is the time to pursue a library expansion or not so much?
From what I understand about the library expansion is that they've been saving up from tax levy money to pay for either repair of the current or add it to their expansion expense. They will need to probably continue to do that. It is also my understanding that they want to have a capital campaign, so the combination would pay then. I do not believe that a bonding issue should be, or bonds should be issued to pay.
That the city should not take on more debt to pay
correct,
for something like
not at this time. I believe that the library is an amenity that is worth supporting. I took my children there when they were young. I don't go there anymore because of the web. I can look things up and stuff, and my children are grown. But again, while surveying Ward 2, there are a lot of families that enjoy using that. And there are even people that are single or older that enjoy going down to the library. So it's of great value.
The Bloomington City Council is, I think, perceived by many to be a bit more dysfunctional than its neighbor to the north in the Normal Town Council. A lot of reasons for that. Obviously, there's some sort of clash of personalities between the mayor and some aldermen. There's a ward system in Bloomington that does not exist in Normal. I mean, there's obviously structural sort of things that tied up in that as well. But if you were to become elected next April and you were to be seated on the council, how would you work to improve the working relationship between aldermen and between the mayor?
Well, I have no illusion that I'm going to make a big difference. I'm one voice. But consensus is arrived by respectful conversations. Conflict is important because there are very controversial issues that need to be dealt with. So through consensus, you work that through. Can I live with the end result? Is it win-win? And then the proverbial phrase or cliche, there is no letter I in the word team or the word ward. And I would step back and what is the goal? What are we trying to accomplish? What is the role of the council in this decision? What is the role of the municipality in the decision? And to remind ourselves who are we serving? And if we collect all that information, I think that a sound decision can be made.
Obviously, the Bloomington City Council and the way its aldermen are elected, it's a nonpartisan contest, right?
Correct.
Nobody waves a flag that says, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican. There's some element of partisanship. The other candidate who's announced for Ward 2, Georgine Chazelle, is a Democratic precinct committeeman, so obviously a Democrat. Josh Barnett is running in Ward 8. He is a Republican county board member, so it's obvious what he is. How would you characterize your own politics and where you fit into this spectrum of politics that as we understand?
To be honest, I'm not a political person. I haven't really been involved in politics in any form. I'm an independent thinker. I try to weigh both sides of the coin. I think it is best to be nonpartisan, if at all possible. I consider myself to be a fiscal conservative. I think that is really the most important thing that needs to be addressed in the city. The city provides services that are essential, that can't be paid for by individuals, and politics needs to stay out of that. And I think that's why the municipal government should be a nonpartisan government.
Well, Alderman David Sage in Ward 2, he's not seeking re-election, which opens the seat for someone like you to run for it. What do you think of Alderman Sage's tenure on the council?
I think he's been a faithful servant of the city. I don't agree with any of the council members' decisions all the time, and I accept that. I'm sure they don't agree with some of the things that I've said, but I do think that he's done a wonderful job. He has served this community for decades. He should be commended.
That's Donna Bolin, a newly announced candidate for Bloomington City Council in Ward 2. She's expected to face Georgine Chazelle in April's election. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find more candidate interviews ahead of the November and spring elections at our website, wglt.org/election. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Ryan Denham. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.